Carl Kemp, author of a book, Promised Land, Exploring South Africa's Land Conflict. Good afternoon, Carl.
Hi, John. How's it?
It's all right. How's it with you?
Yeah, as good as it can be under the circumstances. Yeah,
under the circumstances. Look, I mean, every chapter of this book needs a 15-20 minute conversation. But perhaps let's start with as an attempt to sort of have some general conversation about a book which focuses a lot on very specific instances in many cases. At one point you write that it's perhaps more true to say that we have a housing and unemployment problem more than we have a land problem.
Yeah, I think that kind of argument has been put forward by a lot of other people other than myself, and I certainly think it's something worth engaging with. I've tried very hard to not prescribe to anyone how to think in this book. I think people are sick of that, you know. When I say it's probably more likely that we have a housing and unemployment crisis, I think those are the most prominent features of the land debate. You know, it seems to often devolve into slinging mud about who has the most land and who has the biggest farm or whatever. But when you really get right down to it, when you go walk around on the streets of South Africa, that's what's going to be staring at you in the face. And I think that needs to be highlighted a bit more.
So the examples that you write chapters about in South Africa, Kraaifontein, Philippi, Zwelihle in Hermanus, De Doorns, all of those are, they relate to land because people are moving onto land which is either privately owned or state owned and not earmarked for housing or not earmarked for housing for the people who move onto it. Mm. I mean, none of that is about agriculture. None of that is about farming. None of that is about producing food. It's all about finding a space which is, it's not desirable to the person who lives there, but it's the best option available to that person.
Absolutely. And I think you can go even deeper with that and say it's about some kind of financial stability rather than land. And I think I make a big point about it in the Kraaifontein chapter especially, where you could have a house, you could even have a plot of land, but unfortunately this huge informal housing market has erupted around these kind of both the land grabs and the state-provided housing, and that's because people, you might have a place to sleep, but that's not going to put food on your table, so it's much easier to get income from renting out a space in your backyard.
I don't think people understand, and perhaps I didn't understand until I was reminded and re-educated by your book about the extent of the backyard phenomenon and just how much of a phenomenon it is and how critical a part of many people's monthly income it is.
Absolutely. I mean, I wasn't aware either until I started researching. You know, it kind of hits you in the face, especially when you get in there and you go see what it looks like. And you know, I grew up in Cape Town, and I've kind of seen all of it develop over the past two or three decades. And yeah, the change is staggering. And really, yes, there's numerous instances in the book where I make mention of what is rather crudely termed shack lords. You know, people that will quite literally make a business out of it. So you have one state subsidized housing plot, and you can build 15 backyard shacks in that one area. And that's a fairly damn good income for these people. But, of course, it operates to the detriment of those people who don't have that little plot of land. So, yeah, it's a fairly complex beast, to say the least. And like you said, the scale of it is huge. It's staggering.
The recent ones in and around Cape Town, these happened after you'd put your book to the printers. You know, people, COVID comes and people lose the income that they're using to pay for the backyard space that they occupy. They are kicked out. Yeah. And they have nowhere to go. So they are the corpus of people that moves on to the state-owned land, which the city then goes to court about.
Exactly.
Know,
it's very
that.
Much cyclical. It's very much cyclical. And I think you know, parts of the earlier parts of the book are an attempt to explain how that works throughout Cape Town especially, which I think is the most illustrative out of any metro in the country as to that exact issue that you mentioned.
And also what I found really interesting when you were writing, I spent much more time on the chapters that related to the Western Cape, because these are things that we deal with us on the radio station all of the time. I mean, it's also fascinating to go up into Limpopo and Zeerust and the farms there, where, you know, that's an entirely different approach to it. That is, yes, land has been given. How well have the farmers who've been given that land supported access to market? All that kind of thing is also a very important part of the conversation. But here in the Western Cape, it's primarily about housing, and it's about figures, charismatic figures who sometimes are associated with the political parties whose names we all recognize, but a lot of the time they are not, you know, as in the Zwelithle case and the Land Party and the critical role that small party and that particular individual plays in that dynamic.
Yeah, it was quite insane going into Zwelithle and just seeing the levels of devotion that the leaders of the Land Party there had. I mean, it was literally, they had signage, you know, stickers on every shack that belonged to kind of the Land Party, and it was absolute hero worship, idol worship almost. And yeah, that particular person, the leader of the Land Party, he had joined kind of the original movement, which had from the start been absolutely apolitical. So, and I mentioned this in the book, you know, you think that perhaps a political party that grows from a movement that was stridently apolitical is perhaps a bit suspect, and there might be a bit more going on there than most people may know. But yeah, in the Western Cape, it's very much almost currency, social currency and power to play with these kind of things. And that's why we saw so many land invasions in the lead up to the last national elections. So it definitely is a kind of playground for these activists that have these incredibly charismatic personalities. I mean, the leader of the Land Party caused thousands of people to storm riot police over a fence that had been broken down. That's amazing, in my opinion.
Look, Cape Town is not the only place to which in-migration happens. It happens significantly towards Durban, the Etekwini complex, and to the Johannesburg as well. Not just Johannesburg, but to all of the sort of areas that would fit into Gauteng. A significant inward migration from the Eastern Cape, from Limpopo, from the Northwest. And I don't know. I'm not, you know, you don't want to prescribe, and I don't think that journalists, analysts who write books should prescribe.
Agreed.
But you have to consider what the options are, which ones show promise to, you know, I look around Cape Town and I see the mushrooming of the settlements every time I go along Baden-Powell Drive. Mm. There is a new settlement, or an existing settlement has trebled in size. You drive along the N2, you look on your left as you're heading towards Somerset West after you've gone past the airport. You drive along the N7 and you see what's happening in those areas. You know, where are the solutions to this?
Well, if I had the solutions, I might have been better served trying to go to Parliament. I don't know. I really don't know, John. I think the government tried with the Breaking New Ground policy in 2006 that was so heavily criticized as a kind of beautification project for the 2010 World Cup. I think a big part of it is to disrupt that cycle, right? And the government has attempted this by introducing mixed housing projects wherever possible. So you'd put, you know, you'd provide state-subsidized housing, but in that same development, you'd also provide opportunities for bonded housing. So you have a lot of government programs that also gives financial aid and a boost to people that want to own the house rather than have it give it to them by
with
government.
With what money?
Oh, yeah.
You see, this is where that policy founders, it seems to me, is that there are fewer and fewer people employed, and a lot of the people who are employed are earning less and less, you know?
No,
and COVID hasn't helped that at all.
And, of course, we're in so much debt nationally, so you have to ask where this financial aid is going to come from eventually also. So, no, I to be honest, I think it's quite unsustainable, but it's just one example of what how we try and approach this. But honestly, John, I wish I could give you answers. I'm not an expert by any means. I've just tried to tell a few stories.
And then the stories around land for agriculture, land to grow product for myself, that myself and my family, my extended family can eat and that I can sell. It's to me, it's never been as, although the politicians and some politicians more than others, punt that as being the biggest challenge when it comes to how we use land and how we distribute land. It seems to me that's less of a problem than land for housing, but it is still there. And it is also an area where it's a heck of a lot easier to find failure than it is to find success.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is that that was, you know, this issue about agricultural land seemed to me to have been the driving force behind many of our land reform programs initially, and it's kind of morphed over the years into becoming this all-encompassing beast. Definitely, I think there is a demand for agricultural land for emerging and black farmers, but it's certainly not at the scale of the housing crisis. You know, if you could separate the two, it would be much easier to address purely the land reform issue than it would be to tackle all of the land-related problems simultaneously, which is what the government seems to be approaching with EWC.
And then there is another issue which comes up again and again in the book, and that is the power of the tribal chiefs and the way the tribal chiefs were given extra power by the Nat government because they wanted them on side, and they now have power which they didn't have before 1948. And, you know, the fact that the Ngonyama Trust owns all of that land and the way the king and his advisors run the Ngonyama Trust to the benefit of themselves and not to the benefit of the millions, literally millions of people who live there. I mean, at some point, I mean, if you're serious about land and land ownership and the value that owning a piece of land gives you, you've got to take on the tribal chiefs.
And I don't think that's going to happen, to be quite honest. I think the ANC prefers to consolidate that relationship. It's a very strong kind of voter base to consolidate, and yeah, there's no benefit for the ANC to kind of reform that situation. I think the people who have power are unlikely to give it up. Where would you even start with that? I mean, but yeah, I obviously didn't speak to every single person in KwaZulu-Natal, and I'm sure some people who live in that system prefer it that way. But I mean, the negative effect of it is quite obvious, and it does create a kind of feudal system almost, which is not what we want in a modern democracy. And I think I also mentioned in the book, you know, there's been so much written on how legal systems can coexist and how pluralism can flourish in a South African context, and the ANC seems to just ignore all of that. You know, it's more just consolidating the relationships with the tribal chiefs and letting them have free rein rather than trying to integrate and create a uniquely South African system of ownership and law.
I found this book incredibly helpful and educational. The fact that stuff is based on stories, there is a risk that it becomes academically less whatever grand. But that's the way I think that most people understand life is through stories. And I understand many of the land issues which bedevil our country a lot more because of the stories that you tell about the people who are living those land issues on a day-to-day basis.
That means an incredible amount to me. Thank you, John, because that's exactly what I was going for. I mean, when I was researching this book and reading the academic stuff, I kept wondering to myself how they can expect anybody to take this in and make sense of it on a practical level. So, yeah, that's what I was trying to do. So thanks very much for recognizing that.
And that's Carl Kemp, who's been speaking to me about his book, Promised Land, Exploring South Africa's Land Conflict. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, John.